Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of the Jolly Heretic. Now, the Victorian traveller and adventurer was something of an archetype in the UK, and we don't get your Scott of the Antarctic, whatever, and we don't get that many of them anymore. But it seems that it's a new and rising thing, danger tourism, should we call it? I don't know. And we have one such chap here today who I wanted to talk to. He goes by the name of Lord Miles, and he has spent a great deal of time in Taliban-run Afghanistan, not least at their pleasure in prison. And I would like to discuss with him his adventures and what he got up to, and whether Afghanistan is a salubrious tourist destination. So, Lord Miles, hello.
Yes, hello. How do you do, everyone? Lovely.
Are you actually a peer of the realm, or is it like Lord David Such?
No. I did commit identity fraud, and it seems like it's stuck in my credit file. So, the Lord, I'm working up to it.
Did you buy a Scottish lairdship?
No. So there's a form you submit when you're considered a lord or want to actually be registered as a lord in the UK. And I may have done that in 2019. I put on my best suit whilst at university, and I walked into the bank at the busiest time, so the tellers wouldn't look too much at it. And I just put on my posh's voice. Said, oh yes, my father bought some lands, and he's been knighted, and now he's a lord. And just presented it, and they said, "Oh well, we won't question it." Scanned it in, it went on my credit file, and it's never been questioned since. Somehow.
I'm sorry. What? No, I'm recording a video now. I'm recording a video now. No, I haven't, and I'm recording a video now. Okay, yes, I have taken a slice of your cake. It didn't look nice. So no, I took one that would have been cut. Teenage daughters. She made a blueberry cake last night.
Yes, you need to take another slice, teacher.
I think I will. I will take a very big slice just to annoy.
Good man.
I'm going to absolutely use it. So. Anyway, where were we? Yes. So, where did you go to? You're quite young, as I get the impression, both from looking at you and your face. So, where did you go to university?
Loughborough University to study.
You studied something useful like Arabic or Hashtag?
No, just physics. But then I changed my subjects after 2 years. I went to a different university. I went to London Business School and did banking and finance online.
Okay, banking and finance. And so then how on earth from there did you get into making your way to Afghanistan?
Well, I was going to work for an investment bank, and they had a program where they would pay for your holiday before you start your grueling 120 hours a week or something. So it was a peak of COVID, and the only country that was open to British citizens without the vaccine was Afghanistan. So I thought that'd be a brilliant idea. Nothing could go wrong. So I turned up, and of course, everything went wrong. And the fall of Kabul just happened around me, as it casually does to all of us from time to time.
Okay, so you turned up just as Kabul was falling, just as the country was changing regime back to the Taliban after 20 years of the American propped up.
Oh yes, 3 days beforehand. So I turned up, I was doing some sightseeing, I started posting online, specifically 4chan, just saying, hey, look, I'm in Afghanistan, it's a lovely holiday. Everything's really cheap at the moment, I can't imagine why. And then everyone would say, Miles, the Taliban are rolling over mountains right now into Kabul. I said, okay, I've got half a day still. I can still go sightseeing on the other half of the mountain they haven't rolled down from. So that was lovely. And then as things collapsed, I started driving frantically towards the airport, trying to buy a ticket online. My card gets declined because it looks like there's a purchase in Afghanistan. So I have to call up my bank. And of course, it's an Indian man. And he's saying, oh, sir, you know, you need to do authentication. I go, bloody hell, the Taliban are about to kill me. Get my transactions through immediately. And he's like, oh, okay, sorry to hear that, sir. I guess we'll put it through right now. And then all the flights were closed. And from that point, I was on my own.
Bugger. In the nice few days you had in Afghanistan, for those of us, like most of us that haven't been there and probably never will, what were the things that really stuck out about the nature of Afghanistan if you compare it to any other country you've been to or even any third world country? What were the things that were different?
Well, the good thing is you don't have to interact with many nagging women, so it's quite a peaceful place in some areas. Can't imagine why. They must be so happy they have no complaints. The other reason, I just say it's a very beautiful country. It's very mountainous, so you have these incredible views, snow-topped mountains, but at the same time, it's sandy at the bottom. It looks something out of a fantasy land almost. The waters in the summer can be pearly, baby blue, and at the same time, the food is incredibly cheap, and it's very good. They have the best kebabs out there. But I wouldn't invite them to England for mass immigration just because of that. And what else? I don't know. The people are just
Safe,
friendly. It seems like.
safe.
Sorry.
Is it safe? Like safe streets? Safe?
Well, I guess now it is. Although at time to time it has its incident. I would go as far to say it's safer than London because the stabbing rate in Afghanistan is near zero. But with London, it's incredibly dangerous nowadays. I would never go to London. But in contrast, it's safer than a lot of places.
Okay. And not many women around. They're all in the house.
Yes, or they're just keeping themselves in the street.
And they were they still wearing these complete face covering burqas or when you were there, or were they stopped wearing those because of the new regime?
A few of them were. It's a weird ratio. So I would say 30 to 40% just have a headscarf on. It shows their whole face, and no one has a problem with it. About 20 to 30% have that full head covering look, and about a small percentage have the letterbox type look. But no one really shows all their hair apart from kids up to about 10 years old, 11 years old. That's the general.
Okay. All right. So then it starts to get. So right. So you're enjoying yourself in Afghanistan, and then the Taliban are rolling in from the. Is it the south they control? I can't remember.
Too much.
Yeah.
Everywhere surrounding Kabul at this point.
Okay. Everywhere surrounding Kabul, and in they come. And so what happens? It's slightly worrying. And you can't get a ticket to get out of the country. And what happens now?
Yes, so I'm walking away from the airport and they're rolling in with their trucks and their machine guns. The last area of what to be conquered was the airport. And they saw me and I thought, oh bugger, I'm dressed like a Westerner. I have a cross around my neck. They've definitely seen it and they give me a dirty look. What I should do is I should just cross the road. And it'll be funny because if they let me cross the road, I should be fine. I can quickly escape into the busy market. But if I cross the road, I'll be delaying the fall of Kabul by about 3 seconds by blocking traffic of the military trucks coming in. So I just quickly crossed the road, had no problems. It was kind of a funny interaction. They started giving me a thumbs up and waving at me. I started waving back and said, lovely holiday, and carried on walking. Then out of nowhere in the market, two armed Taliban came up to me and they cornered me and said, what are you doing here? What's your purpose? And I go, oh, a tourist. And I say, tourist, in this time. I'm like, yeah, And they go, okay, well, where are you from? And they say, where's your passport? I hand it to them. I said, I'm from Wales. And they go, Wales? Where is Wales? I say, well, Wales is an occupied land by the English. One struggle. We're just like you. We're going through our own occupation right now. And they're like, whoa. So true. Honestly, enjoy your holiday, man. And then they changed their demeanor completely and let me go.
Right, but then when did it start to get difficult?
Oh yeah, so I turned up at this compound that apparently had Western fighters in. It was a whole UN compound, and as we turned up, there was a huge crowd of people. But of course, I'm British, so I pushed my way through because no one was queuing, so they don't respect the queue. I don't respect them. When we get to the front, there's a Turkish military official there, and he goes, "Oh, only Turkish citizens in." I say, "Don't worry, man. I'm not Greek," and he laughs a little bit and goes, "Actually, come on in." So I get on in, and then I'm greeted by British military, and they realise who I am, and they start shaking my hand and go, "We've seen your tweets. You're hilarious. Lovely. Here's the Wi-Fi." Now that was a terrible thing, so I started live streaming my entire ordeal at that point, and then I had the British SAS commander come in. He's a special forces. And he starts giving me a hard time for recording and live streaming the entire fall of Kabul from the compound. But it's quite all right. And then they all invite me to go drinking afterwards with them. So this is the first time I've tried a drop of alcohol. So I'm having shots of a British SAS. They're giving me a loaded M16 body armor, saying, "Hey, Miles, if you have to defend yourself, that'd be more than fine." We hear gunshots in the background. It's nighttime at the moment. And there's bullets ricocheting off our building and off our bulletproof windows. So we start getting a tad nervous.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, the C-17 is ready for evacuation. So we're led out, and we see a bunch of Taliban whipping a group of people who have tried to escape into the western side of the airport. And we kind of walk through no man's land, where there's Taliban, the western compound, and just us. So as we're walking by, it's incredibly tense. Some people are shooting guns into the air. It gets a bit close to our ears, but it's more than fine. And eventually we get over to the western side. And from there, it's incredible.
You're with British military?
Yes, yes.
I'm so surprised this isn't completely safe, but okay.
Yes, so there's a big group of us, actually. There's about 200 or so Indonesian workers, all males. So they've been working telecommunications and infrastructure, and have sadly been left there. But the British military gets us to the C-17, and after a few nights of waiting around in the airport, waiting for clearance to fly out, I fly out back to Dubai. But the thing is, when I fly out, I still have my body armor with me that's been gifted to me by the British. And because of this, everyone assumes I'm a soldier. So when I arrive in Dubai, I just act natural, and I'm able to keep this body armor, even a few magazines of bullets. And again, I fly out, and when I get to England, I get to keep the body armor, which I shouldn't legally have. It's still in my house to this day. It's a lovely, lovely souvenir.
I'm sorry, so how did things become difficult with the Taliban then? I don't understand. You've got back to England.
Oh, you mean the arrest?
Yes.
Oh, no, that was on my 8th trip to Afghanistan.
Oh, so this is your... That's slightly suspicious if you're going to continuously go to Afghanistan.
Oh, yes, yes. I started doing some business there. So I started selling military surplus. I started selling military patches, Taliban headbands, Taliban flags. And I do make a good chunk of change off it. Because some items would cost $1, I can sell them for $40. And in the volume of tens of thousands of orders, I'm making a pretty penny. So from there, I go back, and I believe on my 6th or 8th time to Afghanistan, they corner me in a Western Union when I draw some money, and they point guns at me. And I turned to my friends at the time and said, "Oh, I'm sure it's a 5-minute ordeal." Turns out it sadly wouldn't be. And then from there, they formally arrest me. They put bags over our heads and they drive us to Kabul and stick us in an interrogation room. And then from there, I find out they suspect I'm a spy. They suspect jolly old me is MI6. And I bloody wish I was, because I'll be paid for those 8 months in custody. But alas, I wasn't. But what happened was, first day, I was brought into an interrogation room, and there's about 8 or so Taliban in this room, all surrounding me in this very small room.
Sorry, when is this? When?
This is roughly March of 2023. No,
and I understand that your friends broke and just dropped you in it. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. So one of my friends, there were two friends with me, both for the first time, rather unfortunate. And one of them sold me out by telling them I was a spy during the interrogations, which made it infinitely harder than me. I feel like I would have been out in about 3 weeks if he didn't lie to them, because they were incredibly suspicious. And of course, they were a tad paranoid because they don't know their understanding of global politics or actually what a spy is. So when my friend just said, "Oh yeah, Miles is a spy, let me go," and sold me out, I was suddenly subject to 8 months of, you know, hardship, even though it was a lovely stay compared to others. But when I was in the interrogation room the first time, surrounded by 8 or 10 members of the Taliban, all giving me death stares, and the senior of them, I later find out, the head of foreign intelligence, so the head of the CIA or MI6 equivalent of the Taliban, they hand me a loaded M16, and they say, "Miles, we want you to check if it's loaded or not. How would you do this?" Now, of course, this is a test. They want to see if I know how to handle a rifle and if I'm a soldier or not, right? So I pick up a rifle, and they expect me to check for magazine, check for barrel, three-point turn, whatever. Now, of course, I turn the safety off, and I point it for the roof of my head, and click. It doesn't go off. There's no bullet in the chamber. It's unloaded. They wouldn't hand a loaded weapon to a prisoner. So I just almost suicided myself, point the rifle at the back of my neck, click, doesn't go off. Then I point it at the head of foreign intelligence, click, it doesn't go off. They're completely stunned, in a state of total stupefaction. So I hand the M16 back to them, begrudgingly, and I go, it wasn't loaded. Why can't you load it next time? Again, dead silence, until the head of foreign intelligence starts cracking up laughing. He goes, oh, this man is funny. I like this funny man. They all burst out laughing. From that point, the head of foreign intelligence calls for there to be tea and cakes and ice cream to be brought in. And then from there, the ice is broken. It was the best networking event of my life up to that point.
But they've been quite unpleasant to you prior to that.
Yes, prior to that, some intense interrogations. The waiting room, or at least the holding cell, wasn't too nice. It was my first forced introduction to a squat toilet without toilet paper, so you can imagine how that was. There were some crazy people in there too. I came across schizophrenics who threatened our lives. I came across Afghans who had been there for 2 or 3 months at a time. And it was a very small space. And the food was just very carb heavy. And of course, there was no sunlight. There was no windows, no mattresses. We slept on the floor for the first few days. So for me, it was rather uncomfortable. And of course, the uncertainty of it, the sheer idea of no one knew where we were. We had no idea what was happening and how long we could be here.
Right. And you couldn't, your parents or whatever had absolutely no idea what was going on.
No one had any idea up to this point.
So they must have been panicking like anything. You're in Afghanistan, suddenly you're in communicare.
Oh, no. I've got no contact with my parents. I don't know my father. I'm an IVF child, and of course, at 18, I've estranged myself from my mother.
Why?
Oh, she's a terrible alcoholic, and she's got huge mental health problems that are unmanageable to a normal person, to a point where the police had to be called over 10 times. She has a massive record, and God help her, but certainly I can't.
Was it that you had a father that was not really your father, or was she just a single mother that got a...
No, she was a father that's not really my father, so IVF. So she couldn't get pregnant, and I believe she had some sort of medical procedure.
All right, and your father, you're not in touch with him?
No, legally, I can't even find out his identity.
No, I mean your father that brought you up.
No, there was no father that brought me up.
So he walked out, he left?
No, it was all IVF, so it was unknown, basically.
She was a single mother that got...
It was an anonymous, yes, so it was a single mother, but she couldn't get pregnant, so she got an anonymous donor through IVF.
I see. God. Yes. So the fact that you were in no contact with your mother, because by this time you were, what, 22 and you were 18 when you stopped being in contact with her?
Yes, 22, maybe 23, yes.
So did this in some way motivate the fact that did you basically have no family?
Oh, yes, it was a great motivator. At the same time, it doesn't really tie me down when it comes to travel, because I would say a loving family, I think I'd be a bit more cautious, because I would have people to answer to, and also people that care about me. I would obviously respect them, because I wouldn't... Let's say I had a girlfriend that was very loving or something, I wouldn't go to some dangerous places, because I know it would either concern them, or if they were okay with it, I would obviously change my risk factor somewhat. But with myself, I could be a bit more liberal, because I understand my own risks, and I'm the one that's actually going there, so I can evaluate for risks at the time. But of course,
at what age did you kind of feel that she was just useless and you were raising yourself?
12.
Sorry?
12 years old.
12?
Yes.
When I can't find enough base knowledge to feed the inner workings of my mind, and I go onto Audible and all I can find is warmed up diarrhea by people like Adam Rutherford and Angela Saini, I sometimes don't know what to do. But that's why I use Legion.com. Legion.com gets the most based books, summarizes them into key salient points, and reads them to you in 25 enthralling minutes, whether it's my own books or whether it's Who We Are and How We Got Here by David Reich, a fascinating book which allows us to understand in much more depth the evolution of man using archaeogenetics, taking old skeletons, analysing the different alleles and telling you exactly how we evolved. Whatever based book it is, Legiant.com is the one for me.
What happened, if you don't mind asking, at 12 that made you have this epiphany?
Yes. So I remember once finding her at the bottom of a staircase and landing, basically collapsed, half naked, in a big pool of her own blood. She pushed herself down the stairs for attention. And I've got a video of this, by the way, so it's proof. And she pushed herself down the stairs by placing loads of items on the stairs, just random household items, just makes no sense, and threw herself down there so she would get attention from someone or anyone. And then I called an ambulance, of course. And from this point, it's become a routine, but it really clicks my head that she's a bit crazy. And then as soon as the ambulance comes, she just gets up and goes, actually, no, I'm fine. I'm going to bed now. And I have no idea why she just did it. At the same time, too, I remember, it's probably earlier. I would say about 10 years old that I thought something was up, because I remember she was on benefits at the time. So she refused to work a job. And that always perplexed me. I don't understand people that don't work a job or can't stand up at 2 feet. But she didn't get a job. She refused to work a job, even though she got free education in to work in counselling, which is ironic. And her benefits, her welfare was cut to about £15 a week. It was a height of 2008, roughly. And then she was saying, okay, Miles, we need to go to these bins, so these rubbish trash heaps behind a supermarket. We must steal the freshly thrown out, the slightly expired food, and then we can get the food and eat the food. And so we would stake out this supermarket for 4 hours a night and just jump the fence and then collect this slightly rotten food and eat it. And it was perplexing to me, because I thought, you got offers for jobs from the government for above minimum wage, and she just refuses to work. She does this very silly game. And even at that age, I thought, you know, this is absurd. I have no idea why I'm dealing with this. At 14 years old, I got a job myself, and I worked 16 to 50 hours a week, depending on if it was school holiday or not. And I just supported myself, and I thought, yeah, this is absurd. I don't want anything to be part of this. Let's just say improvement. There's no reason I should involve in myself in these affairs of someone who's sadly a bit too far gone and beyond my expertise and help.
Did she have like a stream of men over or things like that?
No.
Did you have friends at school that thought it was odd that you went around their houses and noticed differences?
Oh, yes. My mother would never really allow friends over. She would refuse people to come in. But whenever people met her, she was a very sweet lady, so she can definitely play it off. From what my understanding was, she had a narcissistic personality disorder and had mania, so something like that, and also minor depressive disorder. But at the same time, some of those disorders are contradictory. But they were also diagnosed together from the files I found when I was slightly older. So it seems like she was either misdiagnosed or the NHS were incompetent. Who would have thought?
Did she not have parents and things like this, and sisters and brothers that you knew?
Yes, she had 5 sisters, but all of them were alcoholics. So it was all very cookie cutter when it came for problems. My grandfather, I believe, died 2 years before I was born. And my grandmother died on Christmas Day 1 year before I was born.
Okay, and then she gets a sperm donor who, if you look into the data on the kind of people that donate sperm,
yes,
often they're medical students and things like this. They're quite intelligent people.
What I understand was back in the 1998 to 1999 periods in Britain for IVF, one of the donors was actually a doctor. So I do hold a belief that my father was a doctor or somehow well-educated, because they give you a sheet of paper that is written or filled out by the father. That's the only thing or piece of information I can get. And there was one line he could fill out, like a message to me almost. And he says, "Oh, I love studying in university and going out and drinking." And I was like, huh, fair enough. Lovely stuff. But it infers he did go to higher education. So there was some hope.
Okay. So it must be a strange situation when you realise that you're far more intelligent than your mother, and you're brought up by her.
Yeah, I felt like the people surrounding me were a little bit retarded, to be honest. My entire street was the same. So everyone on my street was, they were prancing, crying in the mirror in order to fool the welfare office, a benefits office, to get extra money per week. They'll go from £86 a week to, oh golly, £94 a week. And they would, they were scrounging over this little bit of money, and they were all... I don't know, just silly people. They were concerned about such small matters in the world, and they had no idea about anything. I would ask them as a kid, why?
Where in the UK is this? Where?
Birmingham.
Huh?
Birmingham.
Birmingham. Okay, carry on. Yeah. Sorry. You would ask them what?
Like, I would go to some of these people as a kid and say, "Hey, why didn't you get a job?" Like, I saw a listing at the local supermarket. And they were like, "No, it's too much work. Why can I get a job when I get free money?" And all these people are able to work. And I just felt disgusted by this mindset of a cheating charity and actual people that pay taxes. Actually, I don't pay my taxes, but, I just found it somewhat unclean almost. I found it like these people are scrounging when they don't need to. You know, they're not in need. They're not disabled. Physically, they are able to work. They just find it easier to sit on their Xbox all day or watch a reality TV show instead of working. And then they have one meeting with a benefit office every 6 months where they can just go, "Oh, I'm feeling sad and my body aches and I have back pain," which you can't diagnose or tell, but I definitely have it and it hurts and I can't do this, you know.
Right, and that was what your mother was like. It was a once a week, once a month, whatever you say, meeting, yes, with the Nash.
Yes, she would. I saw it several times. She would practice crying or fake crying in front of a mirror, like some sort of actor before her casting or before auditions, just constantly practicing it. I thought I was bewildered.
But she had some talent. I mean, she could have perhaps gone into acting, but that would be too much effort.
Maybe it's true. I mean, she was diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder. I feel like most actors are slightly narcissistic, to put it lightly, or at least some people in media are quite so.
Well, they are.
Yeah,
they
could have done something. Apparently, she was quite good looking back in the day. She had me rather late though, but I don't know. It seems like by the time I left, she was roughly in her mid-60s, and it made me think, you know. 67 years of this type of behavior. How much hope is there?
So she was in her mid-40s when you were born.
Yes.
Okay. And one wonder. And presumably she'd been on benefits and so forth before that. She hadn't worked.
Yes.
Right?
Exactly.
Why on earth? Where did she get the money from to have IVF treatment?
It was free. The NHS.
Well, isn't it rather irresponsible for them to give IVF treatment to a single mother on benefits?
Oh, exactly. Yes. It was just incredibly silly. But we did it anyway.
Right. Okay, so this kind of... Because it's interesting, because I was going to ask you, obviously, you know, what would motivate... Oh, we've gone on quite a journey here, but
yes,
what would motivate what would motivate you to take such fantastic risks and to do something so avant-garde? And as you say, I suppose if there's just... There's no connections in your life, there's no bonds... Then did you go to university at 18 though? Because that's interesting. So you had every possible disadvantage in life, and yet you somehow managed to go to quite a good university.
Yes. So when I was taking my exams, I was homeless at the time. My mother, it's hard to explain, but my mother, she kicked me out throughout when I turned from 16, 17, 18. She would kick me out for one night at a time. "Oh, Miles, you didn't do the dishes and I'm drunk, I'm going to kick you out." I would just wander the streets. If I had a little bit of money, I would sit in McDonald's and order some fries or something. Or I would just sit around or sleep on park benches. It got a little bit absurd. And I would approach some shelters, but there were no help. And it was all very confusing as a kid. And then when my exams drawed closer, she would go into drunken rages where I would have to either leave the house or she would actually forcefully kick me out for a few nights at a time. And it really did put me at a disadvantage when it came to my A-levels with my studies. But I guess I did pretty well, and I got into Loughborough for physics, so that was okay.
I mean, God. Okay, so you do that, you go there, you finish there, and off we go. So, okay, so you're in Afghanistan then. So tell me about, you're in prison for a long time. So yes. tell me about some of the interesting incidents that occurred when you were in prison. I understand that you were, you from our mutual friend, that you met an African-American ISIS fighter or something.
Yes, of course, it happens to the best of us, yes. So this jolly fellow, he was in Iraq as an American soldier in, I believe, 2011 or so. I can't reveal his name because it's not public at the moment. But the US are aware of the situation, I guess. So I meet him on my third or fourth day, and he comes on in, and it's this burly 6'4" fellow, African-American. And he goes, "Yo, fuck white people. I'm American Mujahideen. I'm here to join the terrorists. I am the terrorists. I'm planning a terrorist attack, and all you white people are going to be killed." So the Taliban are like, again, very confused. They don't know what to make of this guy. And he claims to be Muslim, and they're like, okay, whatever. And then they find out he tried to join ISIS. And of course, the Taliban aren't friends of ISIS. They actually were at a war with ISIS at the time. And ISIS had been decimated from Afghanistan with very small pockets coming up from here time to time. So they're saying, "Okay, you're joining our enemy. We don't appreciate this. You're also American, which is an arch enemy. We don't know if you're a spy or if you're crazy." He just sucker punches a member of the Taliban. And of course, he gets put in isolation. So at one point when my friends leave, because they have EU citizenship, so they get sorted out pretty easily, I get put in this lovely guest house, which is a little bit more comfy. The head of foreign intelligence, he likes me as a person and goes, "You know, we're going to give Miles some comforts. We're going to think he's innocent until proven guilty," whatever. So I'm in a nice place, and this African-American is in the basement below me, chained up, because he's literally crazy. And you go, "Miles, if you want to talk to him, because he seems like he's a bit lonely, give him some entertainment." And I go, "Yeah, sure." So I speak to him, and he goes, "Oh yeah, I'm American Mujahideen. I'm here to join ISIS, and I'm going to basically do a terrorist attack on the Burj Khalifa by doing a 9/11 on it, basically by hijacking a plane. And also, the Taliban's top guy, they respect me so much. I'm not really a prisoner. These chains is just all fake. They're keeping me here as a performance to keep me safe from American Joe Biden, who's listening in on my brainwaves right now. You're actually the prisoner. I'm not. I have a chip in my brain and at the end of my penis that Joe Biden uses to talk to me. And Kim Kardashian also talks to me too. And they tell me, hey, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to attack you." So each night I hear voices in my head, and I have to do a ritual where I tell Joe Biden to fuck off through the power of Allah. and of course, the reason I fled America is because I'm a famous rapper. I'm like Kanye's top guy. And I'm also Michael Jackson's long lost son. I'm worth $100 million. And if you knew my real name, you would know who I am. I'm so famous, everyone knows me. And he goes on like this for a good 20 minutes. And I'm just sitting there like, wow, so true. So true. Mm. His brain's lost, so he's a very good actor. But this man is unfortunately crazy. But I have no idea how he got the money to go to Afghanistan, figured out the bureaucratic process of getting a visa, and all this other stuff. But the Taliban treat him as a spy. When I tell the Taliban, hey, this man says he's hearing voices in his heads and Joe Biden's talking to him, they go, oh, wow. They have the technology to put a chip or a bread or a phone inside his head, and he's talking to the president himself. So we got a metal detector, like a little wand you see at the airports, and they're scanning it over his head. Like, where's the chip? Is it shielded from a metal detector? And I'm just watching this whole thing play out, just with popcorn in my hands, just going, oh, wow, this is, it's at least it's not boring. I come across one gentleman too.
Our mutual friend told me that they turned to you and said, "Miles, are all African-Americans, are all black people like this?"
Yes, they asked me. They were like, "What?" It wasn't the higher-ups, but one of the lower guys who spoke English goes, are we all like this, like black people? And I was like, To be honest, kind of. I was like, there's a good chunk of them, from my experiences at least. Yeah, I've been to South Sudan, South Africa, the whole of West and East Africa as well, and there's certainly a good chunk of a population are like this. We should import more in for West, by the way. That would be good.
Encourage more.
Yes.
Anyway, carry on. So, what were you going to say? So, another incident in your long stay in prison.
Yeah, so I meet another fellow. He's apparently a midget, and he's got an inflated head. So, as in, literally inflated head. So he's got some birth defects. It seems to impact his cognitive function. And from what we gather, the other prisoners and I gather, he's from Turkmenistan, and he went to Turkey illegally after his parents died. He worked in a farm or some informal sector, cash in hand, overstayed his visa, whatever. And after a few years, he got found out by immigration and he was deported. Now, the thing is, they didn't know what country he was from. No one spoke Turkmen in the actual immigration services. So he just presumed he was from Afghanistan. And without any documents, they just deported him to Kabul. And he turned up on a flight to Kabul without any documents and any reason to be there. And the Taliban were like, what the fuck? Okay, we're going to imprison you now. We have no idea who you got here, and we have no one who speaks your language. We don't even know what language you're speaking. We're going to put you in prison until we can figure out how you got here. And then, of course, he was deported by the Taliban after a few weeks of him being in a prison to Turkey, because that's where he
Absolutely.
came from. Yes. So
I wonder,
he just
isn't
left.
there's an Uzbek minority in Afghanistan, isn't there?
Yes, in the northern provinces. But
And I wonder
his.
how similar Uzbek is to Turkmen. They're probably related.
Quite honestly, they would probably find someone who could speak the language. But it's such an isolated country that the pockets of people that speak each language, they can't understand the next village over because they have evolved or at least existed so distant from each other. The accents and the slight dialects are just incomprehensible to each other. Beyond just a few basic words. So there were some people who spoke Turkmen in the prison. They couldn't understand him and that he couldn't understand them. At one point, though, I actually did have my laptop with me. The Taliban gave me the most comfortable stay after a few weeks, I've got to admit. So he gave me my laptop. And then from there, we were at a residential. There's a little thumb on the. Okay. There was a little. So I was staying in a residential building. And right next to it, there was actually a Wi-Fi hub, from what I understood. So I had my laptop, and there was no spyware on it or anything. And I could see next door had a Wi-Fi password. So I spent 3 months cracking, brute forcing this Wi-Fi password. And then one day I guessed the correct password from figuring out common passwords and also the username of the actual Wi-Fi router. From there, I downloaded a Google Translate application. Using a virtual network or something like that. And we managed to talk to him finally. And turns out he's like a chess champion in Turkmenistan. So he's mentally a child, but he's actually incredibly smart. So we end up doing some work with him. Turns out he knows all these university level physics concepts and maths concepts. And it's incredibly strange because we were with him for a few weeks. And we presume he's got the mental capacity of a 4-year-old, and he acts like he does. But then he's brilliant at some mathematics, and I have no idea how he got there.
Autistic savant, maybe. So
Perhaps so.
you get this thing where you get people that, well, normally they're blind and born very prematurely, which he isn't. But the brain damage can happen in such a way that you can be absolutely brilliant on some very, very narrow kind of intelligence ability, but otherwise fairly stupid. And normally that, so there's a guy called Derek Parvicini. He was born, I think, 1979, about 3.5 months early,
Oh, yeah.
blind, mentally retarded, but he's perfect pitch. And you can give him any tune and he'll know it immediately and he'll play it in different styles or whatever. He's like a musical genius. There's other ones where they're artistic geniuses. And Rain Man is an example of this, of an autistic savant who's very good at mathematics. So there could be something, I don't know, something like that. Hydrocephalus. You see, it sounds like he has hydrocephalus, water on the brain. So you get this massive head, and then like a balloon, and then yeah, I don't know. That's fascinating. Okay, God, all sorts. So you got the schizophrenic American. What happened to him in the end? Did they kill him?
He's still there. So last time I went back to Afghanistan a few weeks ago, I sat down with the head of foreign intelligence. We're having a picnic. And I go, you know, the American guy still in prison? How's he doing? They're like, we don't like him. I go, how about if I go to the bazaar? And I pick up a bunch of books and a bunch of multivitamins and a few snacks, and we hand it over to him. Less complaining, less trouble on your end. And, you know, why not do a nice thing? And they go, that's your money. Yeah, why not? So I give these people some nice stuff, but he's still there. I feel the US is trying to do a diplomatic solution with the Taliban. There's a few US prisoners in there, and I believe there's some back-end deal going on.
And another one that our mutual friend told me about was that you met a guy and he said to you, no, Miles, he is a very bad man. He is a very bad man. Don't. Is that the same guy? There was a paedophile or something?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So the black gentleman as well, there's infinite details about him because I spent 8 months with him. But apparently he was trying to find a 9-year-old girl to marry so he can get Afghan citizenship. And he was in negotiations with this one village father to buy his daughter. And he was saying, but not to have sex with her. No. And he just started sweating frantically and looking very nervous, eyes darting around. I was like, I wouldn't have sex with a child. No. And I go, okay, sure. That's suspicious. And I go, have you been in prison before? He's like, yes, but not for raping a child. And I go, okay, well, what were you in prison for? And he goes, well, I was in Thailand. And I came across this prostitute. And the police said she was like a child, but no, she wasn't. But I was in prison. There was a TV there and that was chill. And I was like, okay. And he's like, yeah, but all this other stuff. And he was just, again, these truth nukes would come out of this weird, absurd life. And I kind of debated if he was a spy or not, because I thought, okay, he's clearly insane. I went for Taliban and said, yeah, he's crazy, you know, lay off him a little bit, just let him do his thing, maybe give him a book or two. And he said, well, Miles, we have our suspicions. I go, express them to me. And at this point, they trusted me, so he told me everything, which is interesting too. And he said, well, you know, here's this man's phone. Have a look at this crypto account to tell us what you think. And I opened this cryptocurrency account, and it's $100,000. That was being randomly deposited just before we came to Afghanistan. I think, oh golly, oh bother, this man has been paid by someone $100,000 just randomly the day before he came to Kabul for some reason. And of course, I know spies are paid in cryptocurrency a lot of the time. Like, there was another prisoner, an Iranian man, and he was paid $12,000 in cryptocurrency. He told us he was actually a nurse, and nurses earn about $400 a month in Iran, roughly. So this is an absurd amount of money for him. And of course, it was just deposited in his account too, just before he jumped the border from Iran to Afghanistan. And like, I just think, you know, there's a pattern here forming here. Either there's some weird spy stuff going on, or someone just is really good at crypto trading and people just have huge portfolios that I just don't know about.
So, okay, so you met a number of extraordinary people, and then what? And you're in there for 8 months. And so, what eventually permits you to leave?
Yes. So at one point, they figure out I'm not a spy. About halfway through, they were actually planning on releasing me. They were saying, okay, well, you know, there's two other British spies in Afghanistan. We've arrested them. Miles is maybe the third. We've done our investigation. He's fine. We'll go release him. But then they received a phone call from, I believe, a troll or someone. And I listened to the audio recording. It's some gentleman calling from, I believe it was Denmark or something, saying, Miles is a spy. You need to look into him more. Do not trust him, this type of thing. But they had no idea who it was. I listened to the audio recording. I was like, that's embarrassing, but okay. So it kept me for a little bit longer. And eventually they said, okay, well, it's been 8 months, Miles. We're terribly sorry about this, but we hope we gave you a good time in contrast to, you know, I actually did. Back to our country anytime you want. The other prisoners aren't welcome back anytime, but you're welcome back. We actually could give you an apartment for free. And I go, okay, thanks. And he said, also, we're going to give you this letter. The letter is saying, oh, you're an honorary member of Mujahideen. You can go through military checkpoints without problems. And also, here's the contact of the head of foreign intelligence and a few ministers. You're welcome to come back and do business here and also do any YouTube videos. If you want to do anything that you normally can't do as a normal tourist, we'll organize it for you. And you're a friendly guy as well. And now we're following you on Twitter. Enjoy. Lovely guys. And I go, why not? It's an absurd story, but at least it's not boring. And I believe a good chunk of the reason I was allowed back was because when I was in Taliban prison, I said, hey, I want my laptop. From there, I can read a million books and that'll keep me occupied and, you know, it'll keep me busy. And they go, yeah, sure, why not? But give me my laptop. And I put together a pitch deck on PowerPoint, basically saying, hey, I want to open a gold mine in Afghanistan. I want to do several other projects on an institutional level. I want to bring a lot of money to your country. And I want you to make a good chunk of change off it. We all make money. This is business. And now you're official government. I want to do business with you guys. So then I call all the Taliban into my prison cell, which is basically just a normal room with bars on it. And they go, come on in. I've been waiting for you. Please take a seat. And they're bewildered by all of this. I'm orchestrating it like some sort of business meeting. I tell them to sit down and I go for a pitch deck. And they're kind of like,
are you ready for the future of the West?